will be talking about a very fun project I've been doing for about a year with Larry Kaplan and Leonardo Rastelli about different aspects of symmetric product orbital. This will be related to ADS3 CFT2, but this will be only the CFT2 part of the plan. So what is our motivation for this project? And as usual, for the last several years, the motivation is related to ADS-CFT correspondence and to gauge gravity dualities in general. So in this framework of ADS-CFT correspondence, we have many examples. So here is a list of examples. So the most studied is the ADS-5-CFT-4 duality, where the gauging, where the field theory side, the conformal field theory side, is the usual gauge theory. So it's a kind of gauge theory in four dimensions. Another example of the duality of this correspondence is ADS-4-CFT-3 duality, where the gauge theory, the field theory side, is again a gauge theory, but it's rather a Chern-Simons theory, not a Young-Mills theory. And there is something common between these two theories. These two theories are gauge theories and are theories of matrices. And we understand these theories very well in their perturbative regime. We can start kind of from a free limit of these theories, turn on some couplings, and study and compute basically everything in terms of Feynman diagrams and so on. The next item in this list, the ADS-3-CFT2 correspondence, is qualitatively different from these two examples. The field theory side here is not a theory of matrices. It's not a gauge theory. It's something called symmetric product orbital and deformations of this orbital. One thing which is, well, first of all, it is not anymore a theory of matrices, the kind of the parameter n, the parameter n of un, which comes here. As the size of the matrices enters this theory in a rather different way. And moreover, there is the kind of the analog of a free limit in this theory is not actually free. It's this symmetric product orbital, it's an interacting theory. And even this kind of the free limit or the analog of free limit, the computations are very complicated. And to do explicit computations, it's hard work. Basically, not much that's been done on the field theory side of this correspondence. So our goal today will be just to understand better what is this CFT2, how to do computations here, how to organize computations, and actually to compute some interesting quantities. Kind of the big goal of the whole program is, well, here we have several instances of ADS-CFT dualities, and one instance behaves qualitatively differently. And maybe just from studying it, we can learn more generic lessons about this this whole ADS-CFT program. So our plan today will be very simple. So this is we are working in the framework of ADS-CFT duality, although we will be only talking about the CFT side. But nevertheless, when you are discussing field theories in this framework, there are several levels of which you can discuss the field theory. So first of all, you want to understand some kind of perturbative regime of the theory, some kind of regime of the theory where you have control over the computations. So in the first part of this talk, we will present kind of a diagrammatic language to compute correlators in this theory, which is very similar to Feynman diagrammatic techniques in gauge theories. This will be a way to organize and to understand computations in this theory. Then we will, the ADS-CFT correspondence is a weak, strong kind of duality. So some computations, the computations which are simple on, say, on the field theory side, are complicated on the gravity or string theory side. So what we will do next, we'll compute a large class of protected quantities which don't depend on the coupling. So in principle, we will compute this on the CFT side, and this will be predictions to gravity side. This calculation should be exactly reproducible on the gravity side of this correspondence. And of course, the next item in this list should be going beyond the protected and perturbative regimes. And this is constructing a spin chain for this theory and understanding the integrability structure if it exists in this theory. But I won't talk about this point today. Just talk about. Any questions? Okay, so let us start by just defining what is a symmetric product CFT. We will start, we will discuss the most generic symmetric product CFT without any reference to the CFT correspondence, and when we will do actual computations, we will do them in a theory which is relevant for ADS-3 CFT2. But what is this object symmetric product CFT? It's a very simple conformal field theory. It lives on a sphere, and this part will be important to us. And it has some matter content. Here I wrote down some scalars, but in general it can have fermions or whatever you like. The important thing is that these different fields come in many copies, in this capital N, red N of copies. This will be the analog of N of the UN gauge theories. I will make some analogies between gauge theories and this CFT, symmetric product CFT, but you have to remember that these analogies are not exact, and where possible I will tell you what the differences are. But nevertheless, this is a good analogy to keep in mind. This N is analogous to N of the UN engaged theories. And every field in this theory comes in this large N copies. And we will call this index, which levels in the copies, as the color index, again, in an analogy to engaged theory. And to make this theory interesting and non-trivial, one makes an orbifold of it by projecting on configurations which are invariant under the action of the permutation group. So one identifies field configurations under the action of the symmetric group. So everything should be invariant under just permuting or relabeling, renaming the different copies of the field. So this is the basic theory. And what are the interesting objects in this theory? What are the basic observables in this theory? And as usual in orbifold theories, these are the kind of the twist fields. So this is an orbifold theory, and one can have twisted sectors. And these twisted sectors basically means that you have you put your theory on a cylinder, your space is a circle. You make a full rotation around the special direction, and you don't get back to yourself. Your field configuration doesn't get back to itself, but to some permutation of the original focus. Okay, and because of this invariance of this gauge invariance under the symmetric group, the twisted sectors are not labeled by group elements. Here, H is a group element of the symmetric group, but rather by conjugacy classes of them. Of the symmetric group. This is, again, the usual story. One can then define an operator, a defect in this CFT, which just creates these bounded conditions. This is this twist field. So again, it means that if at some point on your space-time, two-dimensional space-time, you have this twist field, then fields have a monodromy around this point. So again, you make a rotation around this point, and your field configuration doesn't get back to itself, but rather to some permutation of the fields. This twist field, sigma g, is not a gauge invariant of it corresponds to a particular group element. Remember that a particular group element rotates a very particular copies of the field. So in some sense, this operator is analogous to an operator in Young-Mills from gauge theory with color indices, with explicit color indices. Okay. To make it gauge invariant, one associates twist field to a conjugacy class just by summing over the group orbit. Okay. And this object is analogous to, say, multi-trace operator in Young-Mills. And the analogy is a bit better because, a general group element of a symmetric group, how does it look like? Well, it consists of a product of several cycles. Each cycle cyclically permutes several copies of the field. And then one can think of each cycle as corresponding to a single trace, and then the multi-cycle elements, the generic elements, correspond to are analogous to multi-trace operators in units. Okay, so this will be the basic object, and we will compute correlators of these twist fields.
Okay, so okay, so we'd like to compute correlators of these fields, and then just by definition of the previous slide, we can write down the correlator of gauge invariant with fields as a sum over correlators of gauge non-invariant with fields, just by plugging in the definition of gauge invariant with fields. So each correlator here is a sum of terms, sum of correlators on the right hand side. Let us massage this expression a bit. So there is a trivial massage one can do. So first of all, if the each term in this sum is defined by some S tuple of group elements. So when you have S with fields, when you expand the definition, you get S group elements. So obviously, if the group elements differ one from each other just by renaming the indices of the focus, the actual computation of this term has to be the same. You have to get the same number. So you just can group the different terms in the expansion which differ by this global renaming of the indices, global renaming of the colors together, and write down this kind of expression where the correlator of the gauge invariant with field is equal to the sum of these equivalence classes. This curly N just is just a combinatorial factor which counts how many terms you grouped together. And then this is just a representative of each class. Okay, so this alpha, this G alpha, this S tuple is just a representative of a given class. And what we would like to do in the first part of this talk is to understand, to develop kind of an intuitive way to understand this expansion. Okay, usually, well, people have done computations in symmetric product orbital, so how do you think about these terms in this expansion? So usually you think about these terms as corresponding to some covering. Each term corresponds to a different covering surface you can have for the problem. So why covering surfaces are relevant to this problem? Again, twist field insert some defect in your theory, and you have non-trivial monodromy of your field. So it makes sense to go to a covering surface of your two-dimensional sphere where the fields are single-valued, and to make computations on this covering surface. So in a very explicit sense, in which we'll understand in a few slides, each term here corresponds to a different covering map. To compute each such term, you go to a different covering map and compute it, and that's how you can understand this expansion. However, we will first associate a diagram, a Feynman-like diagram for each such term, and interpret this expansion as a diagrammatic expansion, as you have a diagrammatic expansion for gauge theories. Okay. Another kind of technical point I have to mention here, but it's rather important. So several, you have here many terms. Some of these terms are trivially zero. And to understand this, is one can think as follows. If you try to put a single twist field on a sphere, you will fail. And the reason is, say you put at zero your twist field, that means you have some monodromy around this twist field. If you go away from this twist field, say to infinity, this means that you have a monodromy around infinity. So you have to insert the twist field also at infinity. So what this basically means is that the product of the group elements which correspond to the twist fields have to multiply to one in some order for this term in the expansion not to vanish. For you to have a right to write this term at all in this expansion. And the kind of technical point I want to stress is that you have to demand that this group elements multiply to one, not in just in any order, but you have to pick an ordering. And to demand that they multiply to one this order, and this is analogous to just choosing a time direction on your sphere. It doesn't matter how you choose this time direction, but you have to choose a time direction. And when you choose your time direction, like kind of the Hamiltonian intuition, is that you build your operators one on top of the other, and you demand that at the end they multiply to one. If you include all the possible ordering, you just overcount. You can check this by checking your result by OP consideration. So. Okay, so in what follows, first of all, we will postulate a diagrammatic language we will argue that it is relevant for this kind of computations. Then we will discuss how the covering maps are relevant to the problems, and then we will make connection between covering maps and the diagrams. Okay, so let me just postulate this diagrammatic language. Say you are given a correlator of S twist fields, and for simplicity, we will take twist fields which correspond to single cycle. Again, this is analogous to kind of single trace operators in Young Mills. So this N here labeling this twist field is just the size of the cycle. So this operator permutes cyclically N objects. So here is an example of a free cycle. And the way you kind of generate all possible diagrams relevant for computation, you associate a vertex for each twist field. The vertex for twist N field has two N edges emanating from it. So here is again an example of twist three field with six edges emanating from it. The edges are double lined, like in Young Mills, but unlike Young Mills, you associate a color index only for one side of the edge. Okay, the other side doesn't carry any index. Okay, and then the way you build all your diagrams, all the diagrams which are relevant for our problem, is just you take these vertices and reconstruct in all possible ways. You can just connect these propagators in all possible way. And this way you generate all the diagrams. You have to throw away some of the diagrams which don't satisfy two simple rules, which I will mention. One of the rules I will mention later. But the basic restriction is that simple. You write down these vertices and we contrast them in a possible way. And here is just a dual way of thinking of the diagrams, where you dualize vertices to loops and loops to vertices. So you will have in this dual language two types of vertices. One we'll call color vertices with color associated to them, and the other non-color vertices with no color associated to them. Okay. And let me just draw a particular example. So say you are given a correlator of twist three, of two twist three fields and two twist two fields with this kind of four tuple of gauge of group elements. You can check that this multiplies to one. So this is a diagram which is which you can associate to this term, and you can read off these numbers, these cycle structures from the diagram. So here is a vertex A, and say by going counterclockwise, you can read off this series of numbers. So here you have 1, 3, 2. The vertex D is 1, 2, 4. You have vertex B 2, 4, and vertex C 3, 4. And this is the diagram corresponding to this term. And this is just the same diagram in the dual graph theoretic language. Basic intuition here is what the basic kind of the basic interaction you can have in Young Mills is a cubic interaction. So in the rest of this term, that the dual Feynman diagrams triangulate some Riemann surface. The generic dual Feynman diagrams in gauge theory is triangulate some Riemann surface. Here, the basic interaction is a twist two field. In this language, a twist two field corresponds to a square. Okay, so here are the two twist two fields, and the twist three fields are this loop and the external. So here, the generic kind of diagram divides the Riemann surface into squares, into this bipartite kind of graphs. And here is a complete set of diagrams relevant for this problem. So you have a twist, two twist three fields and two twist two fields. And if you follow this prescription, these are all the diagrams you generate. There are just eight diagrams. Six of them are planar and two of them are non-planar. So the thing is, when you write down this correlator as a sum of terms, there will be only eight terms, and you will be able to associate a diagram to each term just by looking on the group representatives of each term and writing down the corresponding diagram. And this works both ways. Given a term, you can generate a diagram, and given a diagram, you can generate a term in the expansion. So I mentioned that you don't just reconstruct your vertices, but you have to follow two simple rules. So one rule is that the number of color loops and the number of non-color loops should be the same. So for planar diagrams here, this number is 4. We have 4 color loops and 4 non-color loops, and for genus 1 diagrams, you have 3 color and 3 non-color loops. We will understand where this rule comes from in a couple of slides. And there is another rule you have to kind of project out the unwanted diagrams.
What is color?
You have your CFT, and each field in a CFT comes in many colors. A number of copies. So the index of each field I call a color.
So what you call L is the color and I is just geometric. That's how you.
So this index is the color.
Yeah.
And this index just.
So
I don't
is this
mind.
Two lines? That's precisely this two indices.
No, the one line is this line, the other line is just doesn't carry any index. This index you can forget about it. This is some additional structure you can add.
Okay, then how the other line arrives?
Okay.
This one I more or less understand. You're saying
it's so it's a bit not intuitive at this stage. Let me continue for 3 slides when we connect to the covering maps, and you will see how this diagrammatic language arises from the covering maps, and you will see that there are 2 types of lines. But essentially, it's a bit less intuitive, but you can associate, like in this diagram, I did associate a number to this non-color loops, but it's a bit less intuitive. You can, when you have a product of group elements, so you have an index of each color, but then you have also kind of trajectories. Okay? You can look how one moves. If you start from here, start multiplying your elements, you can see so 1 goes to 3, 3 goes to 4, 4 goes to 1. That's one trajectory. Then 2 goes to 1, 1 goes to 2, that's another trajectory. So you also have here 4 different colors and 4 different trajectories. In some sense, this non-color loop, well, in a very precise sense, they correspond to these trajectories you can have, but that's kind of more complicated way of thinking about it. But the basic intuition is that unlike gauge theory, where you have color associated for both edges of the double line, here you have color only for one. Okay, and again, in a couple of slides, I hopefully understand this better. Okay, so I mentioned that here there are planar diagrams and non-planar diagrams. So let us compute the genus of a given diagram. And again, these are simple diagrams in double line notation, so you can use this simple way to determine the genus. So what are the numbers here? When you plug your parameters, you get this expression. So S is the number of twist fields in a correlator. C is the number of color loops. And as I mentioned, the number of color loops is equal to number of non-color loops. So the total number of loops of diagrams is just 2C. And I's are the sizes of each cycle. So the number in this diagrammatic language, the number of edges emanating from a given cycle is given by 2 and I. So when you plug these numbers, you just get this relation. And if you saw covering maps at any stage of your life, you will immediately recognize this relation. This is called the Riemann-Hurwitz relation, and it just determines the genus of C-sheeted cover of a sphere. So if you cover your sphere with C Riemann sheets, and I are the orders of the ramification points, of S ramification points you have, this is the relation which determines you for your genus of that covering surface. So again, this whole diagrammatic language and this whole symmetric product orbifolds are very intimately related to covering surfaces. And this is the first hint that you get that covering surfaces should arise. Okay, so using this fact that we can associate a genus to each diagram and then a genus to each term of the expansion of gauge invariant twist fields, we can rewrite a generic correlator as this kind of expansion. You have a summation over some genus parameter, some combinatorial factor, and some correlator, gauge non-invariant correlator, labeled by a genus parameter. Now it looks very much like a correlator in Young-Mills theory, well, in gauge theory in general. And it's, moreover, it looks like a correlator in a free gauge theory, because the genus is bounded from above. Like if you compute the correlators of gauge of composite operators in free limit of Young-Mills, your genus is bounded from above. But unlike Young-Mills theory, where kind of each term of such expansion is very simple in a free limit, it's just a product of propagators. Here it's given by this object, and as we will see explicitly, this object is not computed in a free theory in any sense. This is a very complicated thing to compute. So if you worry about the large n dependence, this looks like a gauge theory, but each term in this expansion, it looks like a free gauge theory, but each term in this expansion is a complicated thing to determine. Then you can compute these combinatorial factors, and they scale in this way, and that's partial answer to your question, because you remember in Young-Mills, these numbers behave as n squared minus 2g. The relation, well, each the diagram of genus g comes as n squared minus 2g. There is 2 missing here. In some sense, this counts the number of loops you have, and here you have half the number of loops. So in some sense, half the number of color loops. So in some rough sense that you can just make this observation without doing the diagrams, and then you will see that the number of loops, color loops, should be the half. If you want to associate a diagrammatic language to this expansion, the number of loops which carry color should be half the number of loops in Young-Mills. So that's what we saw. But we'll see another kind of explanation for this. Okay, so let us, after talking about this diagrammatic language, let us talk about the covering maps. Okay, so how the covering maps are related to the problem. So first of all, let us just ask the following question. Say we are given a correlator of 4 twist fields. This is just an example. Okay, and we want to ask our question, how many covering maps one can build for this problem. And the covering maps relevant for this problem are just covering maps from sphere to another Riemann surface, or from another Riemann surface to a sphere, with these kind types of ramification points. So around, near the ramification points of this, near the points where these twist fields are inserted, the covering map should have this kind of behavior. And again, the intuition is that, say, if you have an N1 cycle inserted at zero, then this means that if you make one rotation around zero on your space-time, you don't get your field configuration, doesn't get back to itself, but after N1 rotations, you do get back to yourself. So on the covering surface, a single rotation will correspond to N1 rotations on the base. And this is kind of local information you want your covering map to satisfy. So what we will do, we will just consider covering maps from sphere to sphere. So the covering maps we will be interested in also have the topology of the sphere. These are kind of the genus zero contributions to the expansion of the correlator. So to completely specify the problem, we can use the SL2C symmetry on the space, on this our space-time and covering surface. We put 3 of the operators at 0, 1, and infinity. And the fourth one on the space, on the base space at u, and on the covering space at another position x, and there should be some, well, the z of x should be u. U is an image of the point x. And so now we can ask how one attacks this problem, how one builds the most generic covering map with these local properties. And it happens so that the answer is very simple. You have a covering map from a sphere to a sphere. Then a generic covering map should be a ratio of 2 polynomials. And it so happens that the information on the previous slide is completely sufficient to determine this map. in terms of this differential equation. So these two polynomials and f1 and f2 are just solutions of a second order differential equation, where the parameters are just, so this and 1 and 2 and 3 are the cycle lengths, d1 and d2 are also combination of cycle lengths, and there are two parameters which I didn't specify. First is this image of the fourth twist field x and some other parameter q. So the point is that the generic solution of this equation is not polynomial. If you just plug any q and any x and try to solve this equation, the solution won't be polynomial. But only polynomial solutions can give rise to, well, to a map. So first of all, you have to impose a condition that the solution of this equation will be polynomial. So when you do so, it gives rise to some polynomial condition on q and x. So p of q and x is some polynomial on q and polynomial on x. And this is a condition for the solutions f1 and f2 to be polynomial. Another condition you have to impose is that the image of the point x is u, just by definition. So here you have two, in general, polynomial conditions on two parameters, q and x. And this completely determines these parameters. But there are many solutions. Because these equations are polynomial, there are many solutions. Okay? A discrete number, but finite number of solutions in general. And the point is that given a solution, you completely specify a covering map with the topology of a covering surface being a sphere. So that's how the different covering maps arise in this example. You have to solve polynomial equation. Each solution corresponds to a well-defined covering map, and each covering map will contribute to a computation of the correlator in this theory. Now, already at this stage, you see that things are very complicated. In general, you cannot solve polynomial equations explicitly, analytically. So for generic situations, you won't even be able to find the covering map. You won't be able explicitly to solve this equation and to find an explicit covering map. And because of that, you won't be able to actually compute these terms in the expansion of the correlator. So unlike the free and Niels, here the situation is much more complicated. Okay, but nevertheless, there are some cases where you can say something, as we will see. Okay. And now we are ready to kind of relate between these two languages, covering maps and the diagrammatic language. So essentially, there is a very simple algorithmic way to construct the diagrams from covering maps. Okay, so say you are given some correlator of twist fields. So this is your sphere, and your twist fields are inserted in some way on this sphere. Then to obtain a diagram corresponding to a term corresponding to a covering map, you just connect the positions of this twist field by a loop. And the order you connect these twist fields by a loop is important. This is relevant to the order you chose in the beginning in which the group elements should multiply to 1. After you connected these positions into a loop, this naturally divides your sphere into two regions. One you can just call the color regions, and the other non-color regions. And this loop is oriented. So say the left side you choose to be color, the right side you choose to be non-color. Then the diagram is actually just the pre-image of this picture on the covering surface. You just take this picture, look how it looks on the covering surface under the covering map, and that is your diagram. And naturally you have two types of loops. One you can call color, one you can call non-color. So here you see how the two types of loops arise. You don't see here why one has an index and the other doesn't, but you see that there are two types of loops. Moreover, this rule that you have to have equal number of color and non-color loops is evident here because of the obvious symmetry of the problem. Okay, so here is an example of a three-point function. You have an insertion 0 and 1 and infinity,
And here is the covering map, and that's how it maps. So we have two twist two fields and one twist three field. So you see that there are four edges emanating from here and six edges. So what we have done, we have rewritten this expansion of gauge invariant correlator as a sum of diagrams, and related this expansion to a sum over covering maps. Okay, and we will change gears and forget for some time about this diagrammatic language and do some specific computations in a specific theory, and then see why this kind of bookkeeping device of just associating diagrams to terms will be useful to us. Okay, so any questions about the diagrams?
What is your coupling constant, which is small and controlled with different
diagrams? Okay, so there, in this part of the discussion, there was no coupling constant at all. The symmetric product orbifold is just, you have a free CFT, many copies of that CFT, and you make the orbifold projection. Then you can turn on perturbation to this field.
But I thought you were talking about Feynman diagrams.
Yes, so like in Daniel's theory, when you have a free theory, completely free theory, but you compute correlators of composite operators, you have Feynman diagrams. The number of Feynman diagrams is finite because you just have different ways of reconstructing things.
Okay, yes, still, what is the coupling?
Zero. There is no coupling constant. Like in Young-Mills.
Sorry, you were talking about vertices associated
Not zero. Well, like in Young-Mills, remember, in Young-Mills, in free limit, if you are looking on composite operators, you have Feynman diagrams. You have many Feynman diagrams, but kind of all the vertices are external. So you don't, they are not multiplied by gauge coupling. You just say compute the correlator of trace x to
You are saying you have a finite, you don't have a series, you have a finite sum, so you don't care if the coupling, you're just summing all the
there is no coupling, but that's the sum is finite, like in correlators of composite operators.
Okay.
And then you can turn on what you actually can do is after you understand this kind of limit, you can turn on some coupling, so add some twist to field. That's what is relevant to say the S3 times S3 sometimes T4. You have some symmetric product orbifold, and then to get away from this singular kind of point in your modular space, you turn on some coupling which couples to a twist two field, to a very particular twist two field, and then the expansion, this Feynman like diagrammatic expansion, becomes infinite because you can take down this twist two field any number of times you want. And there is a coupling which goes.
Right, but what is this coupling? What determines it? Okay.
Well, it's some coupling field. What do you mean, what determines? It's a field theory. What determines?
No, but you are saying it's related to S3 plus S3 plus S3.
Okay, so, yeah, so in that context, it's related to the parameters of the duality, but we won't discuss it. In principle, it's the same proof coupling you have in many else. So it's determined by the duality.
Question. What determines the order?
So kind of the most natural choice of the order you can make is the right radial order. So you have your operators say this is you fix a point, you call it zero, and then you have your operators at some distances from this point, and then you can determine the ordering from this point by the radial order. So if the distance of the operator, of this operator, is smaller from this one, from this zero,
what fixes here?
The point is you can fix anything. The result won't depend on. Fix anything.
So is there any order?
Any order will do, but you have to choose one. It's like choosing a direction of time. You have your sphere, just choose a direction of time.
And can you ever do things like, suppose you've got many insertions?
Yes.
Can you ever have two loops?
No. I mean, this is just a prescription how you build your diagrams. So you build your diagrams by connecting them by one loop. So that's not a property of the theory. That's just a prescription to build this diagrammatic diagram. So the prescription is you have many insertions, connect them by one loop, and that will give you a diagram.
I mean, are the sectors in the CFT where they're connected by more than one loop, or are those?
No. Well, I don't know. If you look on the multi-cycle operators, I don't know. This kind of language we developed was for single cycle operators, which correspond to single trace, well, are analogous to single trace operators. If you have multi cycle operators, then things might become a bit more complicated, and maybe there is some sense in which you're right, but I didn't think about too much. So the simplest prescription is this.
What about covers of higher genus services with quantum
speed? It works completely the same, because this loop is on the base sphere. The base sphere is all the sphere. You connect your things on the sphere, and then you look how they look on the covering surface. So the covering surface can be higher genus. It doesn't matter. So you look how this picture looks on the higher genus surface. But on the base sphere, this picture is completely wrong.
Why is the base Riemann surface cannot be higher genus?
Well, of course it can, but this.
Is that what he was asking? No?
Actually, I wasn't.
Of course you can. You're asking on what kind of manifold you define your theory.
Right.
So we choose to define our theory on a sphere. If you define it on a torus, then I don't know what from this construction survives and what not. It's completely different because, for instance, well, I don't know how. Maybe I don't know. As I said in the beginning, we're working on the base sphere, which is a sphere, and everything I'm saying is correct for that case. I don't know. I mean, in the ADS-CFT correspondence, this theory lives on the sphere, so you don't worry about. You don't have a torus. The correspondence between a theory, between a boundary.
Well, you know that the thing on the sphere, I don't remember.
Oh, it's a.
Well, do you know that your boundary is here?
Well, it's for sure not the torus, right?
Why can it be higher genus here?
How can you build a boundary which is higher genus?
Sorry, I don't get
how do you, this theory lives on the boundary of it.
Are you saying a boundary of ADS-3 cannot have a higher genus surface?
I don't know.
I thought it can. It can. Maldacena and I think Nunes, they constructed an example. Lots of examples.
What it depends on, what topology you get in the boundary?
Where you can get pretty much any genus.
No, but it depends on what? What do you do to get higher genus?
Where is the boundary condition?
Boundary condition on what?
On
metric? On what?
Yeah, on a metric. And I think that was, as far as I remember, that was MS5. MS5 system.
MS5. Okay, so I don't know how to answer this question in this context. I don't know what part of the construction survives there. At least for the simplest case of this. Okay, so any more questions on these diagrams? Okay, so now we will just talk about a theory which is relevant for ADS-CFT correspondence, not just any symmetric product orbifold, but what is called a supersymmetric, a symmetric product orbifold of supersymmetric T4. So, much of the details won't be important to us. The only thing kind of which defines this theory so is that the matter content. So before we were talking about a very generic matter content, here we have saying that it is a supersymmetric T4 means that you have four periodic scalars and the corresponding fermions in this theory. And you can, these four real fermions, you can couple them into a complex pair and bosonize them in such a way. This theory has a large supersymmetry, and you can look on some U1 R charge of this supersymmetry and define chiral and anti-chiral operators. And these are states which just have charge equals plus or minus the dimension. And here is a list of chiral operators. And the only thing which will be important to us that these chiral operators are given by these twist fields, which we discussed in detail before, and they are addressed by some combination of these bosonized kernels. And the fact, the reason, well, the fact determining whether the operator is chiral or not is this particular number. So let's call it momentum. So if this momentum has these particular values in these different cases, the operator has the dimension and the charge equal. Otherwise, it doesn't. Okay. And so what we will do next is to actually explicitly compute correlators of this object, chiral and anti-chiral operators, and see what we get. Okay. So here is just here are just the charges and the dimensions of the specific operators. And essentially, till now, although this theory is relevant to ADS-CFT, this is the state of state of art of this field theory side. These things were computed 10 years ago. These are the three-point functions of chiral and anti-chiral operators. So these were computed in 1999 and 2001 by Yevitsky and Gulon, Zdunin and Matur by different methods. So we will take this three-point function as an input to what we will do next. And the method of our computation won't be able to reproduce these numbers, but nevertheless, they can be computed pretty easily right now. Okay. So as a starting point, we will compute correlators of operators to the generic value of momentum here with this kind of fermionic dressing with a twist of a generic momentum, and then we will specialize to the case of chiral and anti-chiral. Okay, so what is kind of the method of computation? So I was promising to you that, well, from the beginning that we will understand how the covering maps come around and how you actually compute things. So here is one way of, well, one very simple way of computing correlators in this theory. So again, here is an example of a four-point function. And just by conformal symmetry, you can write it as a function of position of one of the operators, this cross ratio U. And by the generic logic of the first part of this talk, you can roughly write this four-point function as sum of terms, where m is just a number of terms. And each term you associate to a diagram or to the covering map. So what is the point of the covering map? To actually compute each term in this expansion, you go to a covering map and to the covering surface. And the point is that you can define, first of all, when you go to a when you compute something, some correlator of this type, and go to a covering surface, in general, going to a covering surface amounts to changing a metric. You had some metric on the base field, and then you go to a covering surface, you change the metric, you have to take into account appropriately the Liouville action which arises from it, and that's the way Lunin and Matur do things. If you do it very carefully, you can compute each term in this expansion on the covering map, but that's kind of a complicated way to do things. Another way you can go is to compute this auxiliary function, a ratio of two, five-point function and the four-point function, where this kind of Liouville action cancels out. So on the covering surface, this correlator is a very simple. It's just a correlator in a free field tube. The twist fields on the covering surface disappear, and all you have to do is to compute contractions between these three fermions. And you can compute this function GGA, Z and U, very explicitly. This is the stress energy tensor. Okay, and then you can use this simple logic by considering the OP limit and looking for the expansion of this function, determine the expansion which is proportional to 1 over Z minus U, which gives you a derivative of the log of the correlator you wanted to compute. So this one, this is the usual way you generate differential equations to determine your correlator. Okay, so you, using the covering map, you can write this, and for each covering map, you write the differential equation, which you can solve and obtain this function u. And that's how we compute things. And you see why the three-point function cannot be determined by this procedure, because the three-point function is a number. So it disappears here. Okay. So here is an example of a computation, just an example of a result of a computation. We take a generic four-point function with generic momenta, but we fix the sizes of the cycles to a very particular combination. So we have two twist two cycles, one twist n and one twist n plus two. And the reason we specify to this case is that we can actually compute the covering map here. As you remember, in generic cases, we cannot compute the covering map. Here we can. And just by plugging into technology of the previous slide, this quantum numbers, this writing down differential equations, solving them, you get that the correlator has this rather simple form. So these powers alpha, beta, and gamma are just some combinations of this moment, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, and alpha 4, and the sizes of the cycles. This overall number, C4, is not fixed by our method, but we can fix it by OPE considerations. And these functions, xj of u, are just solutions to this equation, z of x equals u. Each solution corresponds to a different covering map to a different diag. Okay? So you see, even although we can write this simple correlator in this form, this is rather implicit, because you have to solve this polynomial equation to really know what xj of u is. But you cannot do it, even for this simple case. But nevertheless, we have some form of the four-point function which you can study. Then we will do this in two cases. So first case, we specify the momenta of the operators to a value, to such values. So two of the operators are anti-chiral and two are chiral. In this case, just plugging in the noun in the in general formula of the previous slide, you get very specific powers here. And all you have to determine is this number C4, this overall number. So as usual, you do it by going to OPE limits. So you can take, say, this operator at u close to 0 and look on the singularity. So the coefficient of the singularity is a product of two three-point functions. And first of all, you just can look, study this equation where when u is small, and study how the solutions, how x as a function of u behaves for different solutions. So it so happens that for n plus 1 solutions, it has this form. In particular, x goes to 0 when u goes to 0. And you see that when x goes to 0, you have a singularity in this four-point function. And one solution corresponds to x going to a finite value, and you don't have a singularity. There is a very intuitive way to understand this. You take a two cycle here and bring it close to n cycle. So there can be two scenarios which are either this two cycle and n cycle share one color. Well, these are cycles which permute the same copy. Then when you bring them into the same place, they multiply and actually give rise to a single cycle, in this case to n plus one cycle. And then it's analogous to, say, taking two single trace operators together, which produce a single trace operator, and you have a singularity. On the other hand, if these two cycles don't talk with each other, they just combine to a double cycle, and you have a kind of analog of double trace operator. And you don't have a singularity in this case. Okay, so you just look on the diagrams, on the maps, on the solutions, whatever you like to call them, which give rise to a singularity. You look on the coefficient of that singularity, and it so happens in this example that the coefficient of the singularity for each term is just 1. So the coefficient is the overall number C4 times the number of diagrams contributing in this number of terms, diagrams, maps contributing in this limit. And in this limit, these are the relevant three-point functions which were computed for us 10 years ago. And then you can fix this number C4. Okay. So why did we go to this kind of boring way computation of fixing an overall coefficient? It's because now we can compute extremal correlators. Extremal correlators are correlators of chiral and anti-chiral operators, but when you have only, say, one anti-chiral field, and all the others are chiral. And one can show that if you take this symmetric product orbital, then turn on some interaction, some you add something to your action which doesn't break the supersymmetry of this theory, then these extremal correlators won't depend on the value of this coupling. This will be on a protected operator. So these are interesting quantities to compute. Okay, so here is one example. It's the same example as before, but we choose the momenta of the fields in a different ways, in such a way that three operators are chiral and one is anti-chiral. Again, you have the different the same structure of the correlator, but now all the powers here turn out to be zero. Okay, and what happens is that extremal correlator, this four-point function, is just a number. It is C4 times the number of diagrams, that's all. It doesn't depend on U. It's some kind of topological quantity. And of course, this logic can be made more general, and you can take the most general extremal correlator. Say here is one example of a general extremal correlator, and the claim is that it is equal to some number times the number of diagrams. Of course, you could anticipate this part by the reason that the two chiral operators don't have OPEs between them, and so they don't have singularities. I mean, they don't have singularities in the OPEs. So if you have a function on a sphere without singularities, it should be a number. So that's the reason why you have a number here. Okay, so but now we have a problem. This is a number. How would we fix it? We cannot, when we go to OPE limit, what it basically means the logic of the previous slide, where we had a singularity which was proportional to two three-point functions. Here we will have the same kind of product of two three-point functions, but we will also have a product of a three-point function and another three-point function which involves double cycle operator. So you can either evaluate these three-point functions including double cycles operators and compute this number. You can do it in principle, but these three-point functions were not computed yet. Or you can just use the understanding of the previous slide to make a kind of a guess. What is this number? How to compute this number C4? So the way kind of to understand this guess, you can change this momenta slightly to go off this chiral limit. Then this numbers alpha, beta, this alpha, beta, and gamma won't be zero. You will generate singularities, and then you can go back to the previous case and what you will get that the singularity is equal to this number C4 times this some integer n tilde, which is just the number of diagrams contributing to a particular OP limit, and it will be a product of three-point functions relevant to that limit. Then you can take this moment back to the chiral point, and we'll hope that this gives you the right result, and of course you can check this result by doing different OP limits and doing consistency check. But that's how you can compute this correlator. So the only problem is now, in general case, to compute this number and tilde, the number of diagrams, terms, which contribute in a given OP limit. And here we can use our diagrammatic language. So again, what is the condition for a two single cycles in principle to generate a singularity? The condition is that they join to a single cycle. And that condition translates to the fact that they have a single color in common. So you can just, in this case, you can explicitly write all the possible diagrams relevant for this problem. So here is your correlator, here are all the diagrams. So the diagrams are the same grind diagrams as before. You have four vertices, here are the three, and the fourth is at infinity. And here we just combine the many edges together, just for the picture to be cleaner. So here are 2 and b minus 1 vertices combined together, and so on. So you can count in how many diagrams you have a color loop joined between, say, vertex b and c. And those diagrams will contribute when you take sigma and b to sigma and c. And when you do it carefully, you find that this number is just nb plus and c minus 1. And so in this diagrammatic way, you can fix these numbers. So you can fix this number c4, and you can compute this extremal correlator. And you can generalize this technique to p-point functions, to any p-point correlators. Again, the logic is the same. You take some OPE limit, And this coefficient of the p-point function times the number of diagrams contributing and sum of hitting it is equal to some three-point function times basically this is a p minus one point correlator. So you generate these recursion relations, and essentially you can solve them explicitly. And here is a list of all the extremal correlators in this theory. And things become much more elegant when you notice the following fact. Well, usually you normalize the operators in such a way that the two-point function is equal to one, some simple thing. Here, it is possible to normalize your operators in such a way that three-point functions will be equal to one. That's a non-trivial fact, but if you compute all the non-zero three-point functions of involving chiral and anti-chiral fields, you can normalize your fields in such a way that their these three-point functions are equal to one. If you normalize the fields in such a way, then all these complicated, well, these are quite simple, but nevertheless a bit complicated expressions, can be summarized in a very elegant way. All the extremal correlators are just equal to some trivial dependence on this number of colors n times this number hp, which is just the number of diagrams relevant to a given correlator, number of terms contributing to a given correlator. Now remember that number of terms is number of maps. And in mathematical literature, this number, the number of maps relevant to some problem, have a name. These are the Hurwitz numbers of the problem. So in a sense, the extremal correlators compute Hurwitz numbers, a certain class of Hurwitz numbers. Okay, in symmetric product orbifolds, these Hurwitz numbers are kind of natural object because you have covering maps coming very naturally. You compute things on a covering surface. So the number of covering surface appears in a very elegant way. But say you will have to in principle, you should be able to reproduce these numbers from the gravity side. And there it will be very interesting how these numbers of covering maps arise from a gravity computation where you don't have any symmetric product properties and so on. So let me just briefly summarize then what have we done. So we have introduced a diagrammatic language for symmetric product orbifolds. This is just a bookkeeping device, just a tool to understand how your expansion of correlators looks like. In the same sense that Feynman diagrams are in principle just a bookkeeping device, but it gives you a lot of understanding how things work. In a particular example of these extremal correlators, we were able to use this language to actually compute these correlators. Okay, so it will be very interesting to reproduce these extremal correlators from the gravity cell, from the Warchi computation. And of course, the next step in this program of discussing symmetric product orbifolds is to look on correlators which are not protected, to study just the most generic gauge invariant states in this theory. How do they look like? What is the spectrum of conformal dimensions when, say, you turn on some interaction and so on? Is there some nice integrability properties you can find and so on? So that's work in progress.
So Matur and Lunin, when they studied symmetric orbifolds, they did it because they wanted to understand D1, D5, system, and in particular the extremal horizons. Is there anything I can learn from this? What kind of explicit computations or problems I can solve using these techniques?
Well, first of all, if you are able to reproduce these results in gravity, that will be an interesting non-trivial check, another check of ADS CFT.
Well, we have millions of checks.
Another thing is about integrability. That if you understand how integrability works here in this theory, you can understand again. I don't know if you call it check of ADS CFT or just independent thing. How integrability works in ADS 3. This is also untouched area of ADS 16. If you, well,
this technology just gives you tools to compute anything you want in principle in the symmetric product orbitals. Of course, it's.
But I guess my question is, can it be used to compute something useful instead of, looks the way you present it is that you compute a particular correlation function with say particular momenta just because you can compute them instead of actually saying, okay, this is a problem I want to solve. And
yeah, that's right. You're right.
So that's why my question is there anything, so if you tell me exactly what you want, what problem you want to solve, and then
tell you what our problem to begin with is, what we thought about was integrability when we started this problem. So to understand, for instance, just to understand how you write a most generic gauge invariance operator in this theory, and how you just want start to computing them, you have to understand what is the structure of correlators. Yes.
Okay.
And that's and in a sense, for the integrability, what is relevant? So what do we want to compute for integrability? You want to compute 2-point functions, for instance, with some interaction insertions, okay, say something analogous to one loop computation in Young-Mills. So in that case, say you want to compute a 2-point function of two twist n fields, and the interactions you add are twist two fields. So the basic object you want to compute is two twist n fields and two twist two fields. In that case, you explicitly know the map, and you can follow this logic. So in that particular case, this is helpful. For a most generic correlator, it doesn't give you a computational tool. It just gives you things to organize your computation. And in the case of integrability, it also gives you kind of an intuition how to define a spin chain and so on. But that's still work.
But to compare this Wooten and Matur, shouldn't you resolve this singularity a lot? It's not just a little bit.
Sure.
So you can't really compare it, right?
No. You can compare the protected quantities. If you understand the integrability structure completely, you can compare with anything you want. But
by protected quantities,
it's not correct. So this should be reproducible in supergravity. In this case, you also have Walshy techniques. So. You have to be able to compute. So that would be a nice check. But, I mean, that wasn't our motivation. This Hurwitz story is a byproduct. Kind of, but I think it's a nice one.
Yeah, well, if there are no further questions, let's thank Shlomo again.